Good evening, folks. This is your host, Franz Weinschenk, delighted to welcome you to another edition of Valley Writers Read, where, as I'm sure you know, only our friends and neighbors who live right here in the Valley get to read their literary prose. And so, to start us out, here's Craig Bernthal reading his story, Perfection in Bad Acts.
Perfection in Bad Acts. For Frank O'Dell, Wednesday night in Bad Axe is the chiming chaos of bowling pins, scattering and crashing at Huron Lanes. Each impact has its own musical configuration. And like the church bells around town, clanging indifferently to each other on a Good Friday afternoon, these separate strikings create an unplanned harmony. Laughter, voices, automatic pin setters, balls returning, balls rolling down the bright waxed wood, all combine to drop a gauzy curtain of sound over the sharper music of collision. Frank O'Dell is my father, and tonight he is hot, so things are looking up for the McVeigh's insurance team. His first game was a 230, and his second a 243. He is into the fifth frame of his third game and has bowled five strikes in a row. He has never bowled a perfect game, and he wonders what it would feel like. He tells himself to stop thinking about it. His teammates want to get him a ginger ale, and he almost shakes his head no, afraid any distracting sensation, even drinking pop, will take him out of the groove. But he realizes if he starts to take the game that seriously, he'll probably screw up anyway. So he says yes to the ginger ale so as not to screw up his concentration. They bring him a Verner's, and as he waits his turn, he takes a good long swallow. He flexes the practiced fingers of his right hand and extends them as if he were already holding the ball. Before Dad even started his first game, the Seventh-day Adventist minister's son, Larry Horgan, was pouring coins out of the jelly jar where his mother kept her spare change. Larry's payments from the A&P went into the bank, so he had no spending money, thus keeping opportunities to sin to a minimum. He took 2 dimes, 5 pennies, and a quarter from his mother's change jar. He decided to go to the Bad Axe Theater. It had red and blue neon lights, which outlined the words Bad Axe, in the shape of a broken hatchet. He had never been inside the theater, which people in Bad Axe simply called the show, though it had exerted an awful pull on him. Larry's church didn't allow watching movies or television, dancing, drinking, or card playing. Bowling and billiards were too far beyond the pale to need mention. But West Side Story had been re-released, and he wanted to see it. For a week, he had gazed at the posters featuring Natalie Wood, and she was the most beautiful creature he had ever seen. Tonight was the last showing. His parents were driving to Tri-City Airport to pick up a visiting missionary from Africa. They'd left early to make time for an uncharacteristic indulgence, dinner in the Sky Room. It was almost as if God were giving Larry a chance to see the movie, which, Larry admitted to himself, seemed unlikely. But whether this happy concurrence of events was of divine or satanic origin, Larry intended to make the most of it. With the show starting at 7, he'd have plenty of time to get home before his parents returned from the airport 70 miles away. His mother wouldn't miss the change. He went out the door into the clean, clear air. Just a few snowflakes were coming down, and he joyfully kicked his way through the little drift in the front yard. Al McLean looks like a human bowling ball, the Verner's gnome, a tobacco-stained Santa Claus moonlighting during the off-season as a bowling proprietor. He has a round, tight belly and curly black sideburns much longer than the style. He wears the same colorless pants and shirts every day and gray-green suspenders. Always suspenders. Children are in awe of him. He is 5 feet 6 inches tall. He is the dwarf, the underground creature who makes the bowling alley work, though no one knows how. He is the owner of Huron Lanes, never without a cigar between his thumb and forefinger. He holds his cigar that way because that's how his father held his. Holding a cigar between your fingers is effeminate, something a cigarette smoker might do. Many people who have bowled at Huron Lanes for years have never actually seen Al put a cigar to his mouth. However, the butts of his cigars pile up in ashtrays at the front desk next to the brass cash register, so people guess he must be smoking them. Dad has known Al for years, gone deer hunting with him every fall, and actually seeing Al take drags off his cigars. But Al seems more interested in adding smoke to the general atmosphere than in taking it directly into his lungs. A lot of the time, Al's cigar goes out, but he still holds it for an hour at a time, telling customers slow stories in his rumbly basso profundo voice. They have heard all the stories before. Al knows he's probably told the same people the same stories, though he is never quite sure. He is willing to take the risk, however. His stories add necessary ritual to the bowling alley, a proper rhythm, the liturgy of a Wednesday night. Al is the least hurried man in town, and when people are around him, they can't hurry either, and mostly don't want to. While my father was on the fifth frame of his still-perfect game, I was not quite dead drunk in the snow-laden shrubs directly in front of Al McLean's house. I had been seized with grief over what I'd done to his wife, Clara, a few months before, and was staggering toward his home to apologize once again, to apologize more effectively. But as I trudged across his front yard, the world tilted on its side, and I found myself on the ground, face up, staring into the infinite lines of falling snow, each flake leaving a vapor trail behind as it fell to earth. The shrubs had dumped several handfuls of snow down the front of my shirt, and my body was going into deep freeze. I could hear the minute chiming of big snowflakes bumping into each other. It was like the sound you hear at wedding receptions, when the guests are all tapping spoons against wine glasses, urging the bride and groom to kiss. But it was much fainter, more melodic, and contained no urgency whatsoever. I had never heard the chiming of snowflakes before, and I felt quite content to listen and slowly fall asleep. But before I fall asleep and wake up in Hubbard Memorial Hospital, I must go back to an earlier point in the day, before the league bowling at Huron Lanes, before Larry rips off his mom to go to the movies, even before I've had my first drink. I was working at the A&P with Larry, just getting off, and as usual, we stopped at Jim's Pure Service across the street. I got some potato chips to split with Larry. Inside, we sat on low ledges by the plate glass windows, talked, and watched cars pull up, belching white clouds into the winter air. The kids who pumped gas for Jim were friends of mine, mostly high school football players who, unlike me, hadn't been caught drinking. Customers left their cars and came in to talk. The cold little room reeked of gas and oil, and we blew on our lightly fisted hands to warm them up. You could find out anything at Jim's, and Larry and I liked to be in the know. Information, not gossip, was passed back and forth constantly. Did you hear about the four couples engaged in wife swapping in town? The mechanics and gas pumpers at Jim's could fill you in. Were you interested in the last time the Baptist minister beat his wife? Who your cute French teacher slept with a couple nights ago? Jim's had the answers. The place held another attraction for me. If you were under 21 and wanting some liquor for Friday night, Jim's son, Jimmy the Bomb, just out of the Marine Corps, had no problem picking up a bottle or two for you at the liquor store on the east side of town. It was this little feature of Jim's that made the place especially valuable to me. At 16, I liked to drink on the weekends. The previous spring, I'd gotten kicked off the football team for illegal possession. Dumb luck. I'd been in a car with a bunch of other guys. They'd had some beer and we got stopped. I'd had one can of Stroh's. Kids caught drinking were not allowed to play sports for a year. So I got a job at the A&P and spent my time other ways. Jimmy the Bomb had agreed to get me a couple bottles of black and white scotch for the weekend, but I'd asked him to pick it up on Wednesday because I was working till 9 on Friday night. My drinking was creeping into the week. He said, "What's wrong with Friday after 9? I said, "I don't want to mess up your Friday night." He said, "I'm not doing anything." I said, "Well, I'll have to go home after work and change. Just thought this might be easier." He shrugged, looked at me a little funny. But ex-Marines didn't bug future Marines about their drinking habits, and when Larry and I got to Jim's Pure after work, he had the booze, which I transferred carefully from his old Dodge pickup to an A&P supermarket bag. Larry, who was with me, frowned but said nothing. "When are you going to have a drink, Deacon?" Jimmy laughed and squeezed Larry's shoulder. "You're Catholic," Larry said. "You've got a long tradition of wine bibbing in your church. We use grape juice." Larry was okay by Jim, though Larry had a long face, a serious demeanor, and was unfortunately twisted up in his family's religion. Hence, Deacon, a nickname Larry had acquired in junior high. "I have high hopes for you yet," Jim said. "You sure you don't want something?" Larry shook his head. "Well," Jimmy nodded at me, "Doug here's got plenty for the both of you." Larry went home. I went to Charlie Gore's house to drink. Charlie's dad ran the local pool hall in the basement under Clevenger's. It had an ugly assortment of warped tables and cue sticks, but the disreputable men who played there factored in all the curves. Mr. Gore was seldom home, and neither he nor Flora, Charlie's mother, much cared what their son did, though Flora complained about how much Charlie ate. Flora was wiry and strong, as thin as her son was fat, and she had the vilest mouth I've ever known on a woman. Charlie was my age and must have weighed 300 pounds. A few weeks before, I'd watched Charlie eat a whole pecan pie by himself. His mother had made it for Christmas, and Charlie just sat down and ate it by the giant spoonful. He didn't offer me any. "Jesus," Flora said when she came in the kitchen and saw Charlie scarfing down the pie. "You're getting so fat, you got tits like a woman." Then she grabbed one of them and squeezed. Charlie, his gullet full of pecan pie, could only utter a strangulated yelp and try to get away. But she dug her talons into Charlie's boob like a giant staple remover. He got up and yowled, jigged around the kitchen, shaking this way and that, bellowing, while Flora was whipped around like a noodle. Finally, she let go. "Don't go eating my pies unless I say you can, lard ass," she said. Charlie sat down, massaged his breast, and finished the pie. Any form of gluttony and retaliation was possible in the Gore household. Flora was English and had found her husband during the war. She didn't see anything wrong with taking a couple shots of gin to start the day. She was a steady drinker, but I never saw her drunk. You can have a drink every hour or so and float through the day in a pleasantly sodden haze. I enjoyed feeling that way and had drifted rather easily into the Gore household. So my next stop after Jim's pure was Charlie's. I put the scotch on the kitchen table, Charlie got a couple glasses and a euchre deck, and Flora came out of the living room where she had been watching The Price is Right, her nose twitching with excitement. "Black and white," she said, "my favorite." She went to the cupboard and got out a giant jar of Planters salted nuts and slammed them down on the table, as if to say, "Let's get going." Sometimes Flora ran out of money for booze, and this must have been one of her dry spells, because she started drinking with unusual gusto, and I felt I had to keep up to protect my investment. Charlie, of course, matched us, and before long the peanuts and most of the first bottle were gone. What the hell, I thought. I owed Flora a few drinks. We dipped into bottle number two. We were playing Shoot the Moon, and cards flew across the table. Charlie and I kept forgetting what was trump. By the time Larry walked into West Side Story, I was reeling. The first thing Larry noticed was the smell of popcorn. Mr. Pell, a frail, bent little man with a bald head who'd run the theater for years, took his ticket. Charlie stepped into a hallway which had a long window covered with burgundy velvet curtains. On crowded nights, if you came early to the 9 o'clock show and the 7 o'clock hadn't let out yet, you could get in and watch the ending of the movie by pushing those curtains aside or by going to either end of the hall where the aisles came out. Few people did this. If they came in early, they listened to the soundtrack but avoided peeking at the show. I heard the whole Battle of Fort Knox at the end of Goldfinger without peeking, but it was a darn strain. Larry was one of those who'd never peek. He entered the theater. The house lights were still up. All the seats were empty. Larry took a spot in the very center and waited for people to come in. He enjoyed the silence. The light hair on his forearms rose in the charged air. Larry scrunched down, a little afraid someone would recognize him, but then realized no one from his church would come, or if they did, they couldn't accuse him of debauchery without implicating themselves. He relaxed a little, and no one came. No one on a Wednesday night was interested in seeing a re-released West Side Story. This show, Larry realized, was just for him. The lights went off, the blue clock over the left exit glowed, and the first atonal, whistling strains of West Side Story made Larry shiver as the New York skyline began to take shape. Flora knew every card that was out, and I finished owing her $5.50. While Maria and Tony were singing Tonight, I was trying to get down the unshoveled and icy steps of the Gore's back porch without falling. My stomach churned, the world wobbled, and I wanted to upchuck into the bushes that struggled for life in the Gore's backyard. The fastest way home was down Main Street, Huron Avenue, but I was not going to go that way because I was falling down drunk. I heard the door open behind me. "You forgot your hat, Dougie," Flora said, and threw it to me in a loopy overhand. It sailed over my head. "Rats," she said, and backed unsteadily into the house. I heard the door slam. I made it to the hat, bent over to get it, and my stomach gave up the scotch that hadn't already entered my bloodstream. I left the mess and started to stagger home, the back way, down the residential streets of Bad Axe, past the elementary school and Sacred Heart Church. I longed for mouthwash. Dad was in the middle of his second game. Al McLean was presiding over a seamless night of league bowling. Larry had entered that state where man and movie are one, and Maria had convinced Tony he had to stop the fight between Bernardo and Riff. Al McLean's wife, Clara, reclined on the sofa watching TV. The arthritis in her knee and the tightness in her ribs made moving harder for her. She didn't go to the bowling alley as often as she used to, when she was a jolly companion to her husband. No, she pretty much hung out at home now, tired, different than she had been before, and it was my fault. I changed direction and headed toward Clara. By the time Dad gets to the eighth frame of his third game, he is still perfect. A buzz has gone round the bowling alley, and more bowlers, as they finish their turns, drift over to watch, and then go back to their own games. Al has the best spot, and he isn't budging. He and Dad used to bowl in tournaments in Chicago, and he's almost as excited about this game as Dad, who is talking to himself in his head, trying not to think himself out of his streak. He's thinking, "Don't think, don't think." A bowler on the Farm Bureau team picks up a split, and then it's Dad's turn. He gets his ball, rolls his shoulders around, and then his head. He sets, willing his mind to go blank. There is only a motion to make, and he must not think about that. He must not even think about starting to move. He must not think about not thinking. He pauses on the alley like a statue, man the bowler, until all else dies away, and then his left foot moves forward. He takes five steps, a little shuffle, and the ball is on the alley, Dad's arm curving to the ceiling in a graceful follow-through. He stops, fixed in space, and then becomes a spectator like everyone else. The ball seems too far to the right, rolling, rolling to a split, but it arcs back into the pocket. Pins fly all over the place, trying to find other pins to knock down. It's like Dad's thrown a hand grenade. The pins just disappear in the blast. McVeigh's insurance cheers. The Farm Bureau team cheers. "Attaway, boy," Al McLean shouts. I made progress slowly toward Clara McLean, a 15-minute walk that stretched into half an hour and longer. My dizzy spells got worse and worse. I leaned against the elm trees, their cold, tacky bark hard against my cheek. I progressed by sprint from tree to tree, and at each tree I hung on for a while until I got where I needed to go. The air barely stirred, but the night was cold, and my windbreaker did little to keep me warm. I had no gloves and didn't want to think about my hat. The McLeans lived in a typical house for Bad Axe. It was probably 50 years old, at least, had two stories and a front porch. As I walked across the yard, I imagined that Jack Frost had drawn his skittering diagrams across the inside of my veins. I had never felt so painfully cold. My eyes spun, the world upended, and I found myself sprawled in the shrubs. Light from the house escaped the curtains and fell across my legs. I thought, why not rest for a while? I must straighten my thoughts before I talk to Clara. I nestled my head into the snow and watched the tipsy flakes fall to earth. I listened to their music. The world no longer threatened to flip over and dump me into space. I'm sorry, I thought. There must be something I can say besides, I'm sorry. I recalled the day 6 months before when I'd run into Clara McLean. I was in a bike race, a race that had sprung out of nothing. No challenges had been issued, no finish line specified. The evening air was like silk, and I was with Larry Horrigan and a couple other guys, all of us just a few months short of getting our driver's licenses. We were pedaling south on Northport Crescent. poking along, and one of the guys, with a little smirk on his face, began to pedal just a little faster. Smirking back, I went past him. The other two moved up. It was like a food fight, when you've got a little ketchup on your finger and you flip it at a guy, then he deliberately puts mustard on his and flips it at you. Before any of us knew it, we were bombing down Port Crescent as fast as we could go. We pedaled crazily on our Schwinns, big, heavy bikes without gears. When we got to where North Port Crescent intersected Huron, I saw a chance to take the lead and cut through the driveway and gas pumps at Jim's Pure, tilting into the turn, yelling and shrieking. A couple of Jim's customers scattered to get out of the way. One man nearly climbed his car, another dived into Jim's doorway. A few seconds later, I was swollen with power, intoxicated with my own craziness. The other guys whooped and yelled behind me. Huron Lanes is next to Jim's Pure, and I think if we'd come straight down Huron, Clara might have seen us, but because we cut the corner, we were invisible to her. The car door opened, Clara got out, and I hit her. We flew, like one congealed mass, into the door, which strained to come off its hinges. We hung there for a long moment until the car door pushed back. The handlebars wrenched and spun from my hands. I caught the end of one of them in my gut as the bike came out from under me, and we crashed in a heap. I landed under Clara and the bike. I tried to pull myself out from under, but I was caught. Then Clara started to sob. People in the bowling alley slowly realized there'd been an accident. Al came out, trying to help Clara get up. I was trying to catch my breath. Somebody pulled me out from under the bike. Al started to cry along with Clara. Before they got her in the car to go to the hospital, Al looked at me, halfway between accusation and concern, tears running down his cheeks, and said, "Doug, are you okay? Did you get hurt?" I couldn't speak. I just shook my head. I had been standing there, holding my side, watching Clara crying. Somebody pulled his station wagon around to Clara, and Al tenderly helped her into the back seat. Al's, "Doug, are you okay? Did you get hurt?" echoed in my brain. God. Clara had cried harder when she moved to the car. My bike was unrideable. The front wheel was twisted. It takes a hell of an impact to do that to a Schwinn. I left the bike at the gas station, and Jim gave me a ride home, where I told my parents what I'd done to two of their best friends. They went straight to the hospital. I went upstairs and cried. Clara had two cracked ribs and a knee that might have been clipped by a pro football player. Her left side was one big bruise. When Dad came home, he found me upstairs, just past the blubbering stage. He put his hand on my shoulder and said, "Doug, I don't know what gets into you sometimes. Jim told me you nearly mowed down two of his customers before you hit Clara. How is she?" "She's still crying, the poor thing." I went with my parents to see Clara in the hospital. She had a black eye, her side hurt, and she groaned when the nurses tried to get her out of bed. Al was there when we visited. I could barely look at him or Clara. I said I was sorry, really, really sorry. I thought I'd wrecked my dad's friendship with Al, but Al was more decent than that, and so was my dad. I stayed out of the bowling alley and cringed when I had to walk past its big windows. Whenever I saw Clara limping the short distance from her car to a store or the bowling alley, I wished my body would unravel, atom by atom. Larry Horgan leaves the Bad Axe Theater with tears in his eyes. He is still hearing, "There's a place for us." West Side Story is the most beautiful thing he has ever seen. Natalie Wood leaves a hollow ache in his gut. He will sneak to the movies many more times before he finally gets caught. And then he will turn his back on his father's church, even though he will still have to go every Saturday until he leaves for college. West Side Story will break the first part of his life away from what follows, the way a dead twig can be snapped from a tree. When Larry comes out the theater door, the work of 3 hours' heavy snowfall lies before him. The steps to the theater are pristine, covered in loose snow. The whole city is wrapped in it. Only in the streets, where a few cars have passed, is the white layer marred. Parking meters wear white caps and stick up from the sidewalk like a rank of frozen old men. The town's only stoplight, 3 blocks away, fills the streets with green, then red. Larry holds his breath. His tears freeze to his cheeks, and he decides to walk home along the back streets, which are even quieter and more mysterious than what he sees before him. After Chino shoots Tony dead, before Dad gets to his eighth frame, I am mostly buried. I watch the snow come down like a hazy mass of starfall, hear the flakes bumping into each other, making chords and chimes like bowling balls hitting pins, only faint, faint. I am surprised I've never heard snowflakes before. For me, that night, the chime of colliding snowflakes becomes the sound of bad acts. The snow doesn't so much pile onto me as I sink into it. The light from Clara McLean's window falls aslant my legs. I tell myself to get up, but lying there, listening to the snow, is so pleasant that I lose the will to move. My foot sticks up impudently on the old frozen snow, and the little breeze swirls, keeping it from getting covered. I think I'd be more comfortable if someone would come along and pull the white blanket over my foot, but doing it myself is too much trouble. The snow covers my eyes. Larry walks down Hanselman Street, sticking his tongue out to catch snowflakes. He wouldn't do such a childish thing if anyone were in the streets. But it's wonderful to be alone in a snow-filled city. Maybe, Larry thinks, school will be canceled tomorrow. He zigs up and down the side streets, in no hurry to be home. His parents will have to drive very slowly on the way back from the airport, and even if they beat him home, he'll just say he's been out for a walk, which will be true. Larry goes past the McLean's house and glimpses something odd out of the corner of his eye. He keeps walking for half a block until what he has seen develops in his mind like a Polaroid going from cloudy to clear, a shoe sticking out of the snow. He turns around slowly and walks back to the McLean's yard. Then he runs. He grabs my shoe and starts dusting the snow away, discovering the blue jeans connected to the shoe. He brushes snow away as fast as he can, working his way up until he is smacking my nose back and forth. "Doug," he shakes me. "Doug, are you okay? Wake up." He bounces me around. I can sort of feel it. He grabs me under the arms, pulls me across the lawn, onto the sidewalk, and up the McLean steps. My feet go thunk, thunk, all the way up. Larry rings the McLean's doorbell again and again, then pounds on the door. It opens and light floods the porch. Clara is in a house coat, clutching it around her, trying to keep warm. "It's Doug O'Dell, Mrs. McLean. I found him in your yard. I think he's frozen." Dad is in the ninth frame. The other games have almost stopped. People in the bowling alley are straining to see what is going to happen on alley three. When Dad makes the strike, a huge cheer goes up. Al McLean is not only smoking his cigar, but chewing it as well. So much smoke is going up, he might as well be a train engine. When Dad gets to the 10th frame, a hush settles over the place, the kind of hush that can only be accentuated by an announcer's whisper, like on big-time bowling when Ray Bluth goes to the line. The woman who tends the pop bar tugs on Al's sleeve. "Not now," he grumbles. She pulls again and whispers something in his ear. He goes to the phone and drops his cigar. Dad goes into his five-step approach dance and releases the ball. He's so smooth tonight you can't even hear the ball hit the alley. It's heading for the pocket, and everyone knows it's another strike. Down comes the pin setter to clear away the debris. Dad waits for the ball to return. Al, who no one has ever seen hurry, except for the time I ran into Clara, shoulders his way through the crowd, grabs Dad by the arm, and whispers in his ear. The ball comes back. The pins are set up. Does my father look wistfully at the pins, the crowd, his hand, which ought to fit into that ball? He is heading for the door as fast as he can, with Al hot behind him. Larry drags me inside. Clara soaks a bath towel with warm water and slaps it on my chest. I go from numb to simply freezing. Dad and Al arrive. Larry and Dad toss me into the back seat of Dad's car like a Yule log and take me to the hospital. I want to say something, but my jaw feels rusted shut. Nurses strip me and put me in a big tub of hot water. I am not so frozen that I can't be embarrassed. When I start to shiver, I think I will shake myself to pieces. I can't stop. Early the next morning, my father and mother and Clara and Al come to the hospital. Clara puts her hand on my cheek and leaves it there, as if touch could heal. It is an old, very soft hand. And against the light on the ceiling, Clara looks like a wrinkled, white-haired angel engulfed in halo. "Doug, you gave me such a scare," she says. "I'm sorry," I croak. "I'm sorry." She smiles softly at me. "I know," she says. Later, Larry shows up. He tells me, "If I hadn't sinned and gone to see West Side Story, you'd be dead." At Jim's Pure for the next week or so, people will debate these events. Did the alcohol in my veins keep me alive, like antifreeze? Or nearly kill me, like the doctor said, because it shut down my shivering response? The antifreeze theory will be popular at Jim's. Would Dad have made those last two strikes? Some will say yes, he was in the groove, but others will argue that under the mounting pressure of 10 straight strikes, he would have been more likely to falter. They will debate more heatedly over whether Dad should have stayed and bowled those last two balls, or whether Al McLean should have said anything about me until after the game. I will be labeled a royal pain in the ass by the whole town. "And what about my father?" they'll say. "He was so close. He'll wonder for the rest of his life whether he could have bowled a perfect game. What should he do with a kid like me?" I feel bad, of course, but for the first time since I hit Clara McLean, I feel better.
That, friends, was Craig Bernthal reading his story, Perfection in Bad Acts. The story leaves us with a lot of ifs. You know, if Larry hadn't disobeyed his parents' rules and not gone to that movie, he never would have discovered his friend Doug, who surely would have frozen to death. The doctor theorized that if Doug hadn't had so much alcohol in his veins, he probably wouldn't have made it. And, of course, if he hadn't been called away, Frank, Doug's father, might have bowled a perfect game. Yep, that's right. Life can be mighty iffy, can it? Thanks, Craig, for a really engaging story. Friends, not only is Craig Bernthal a fine author, as you've just heard, I'm personally indebted to him because he was a wonderful professor of mine a few years back when I took some classes at Fresno State University. Besides being a popular professor, a prolific writer, and a Shakespeare scholar, Craig has published two books, a collection of stories, from which we heard the lead story tonight, and a scholarly work entitled The Trial of Man, Christianity and Judgment in the World of Shakespeare. Thanks again, Craig, for that great story. We hope you're crafting another one for us for next year. And so we come to the close of another edition of Valley Writers Read. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to hear tonight's or any other Valley Writers Read story again, just go online at kvpr.org and click on to Valley Writers Read. Next week, our writer-reader will be Randy Sibley. In the meantime, this is your host, Franz Weinschenk, wishing you and yours a great life story until we meet again. Good night.
Valley Writers Read is a production of Valley Public Radio produced by Don Weaver and Franz Weinschenk. Please join us again next Wednesday at 7 p.m. for another edition of Valley Writers Read.